joining us right now, I am so excited to say these words.
What are you going to say?
Welcome aboard Enterprise Incidents, William Shatner. This means the world.
You mean you want to talk to me?
Definitely want to talk to you. Good. And what I want to talk to you about, Bill, is your latest book called Boldly Go, which came out on October 4th, 2022. And on October 5th, I went on a plane ride to a film festival in Spain, and I read the entire book on the way to Spain.
No kidding. I've never even done that.
It is fantastic. This book is fantastic.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, Scott, that's delightful to hear.
It is. What I have to say about Boldly Go is I feel like it's volume two to your previous book, Live Long and ... because both of these books are very profound. You're very candid about the ups and downs of your life, of what you learned and what you hope other people learn. But why did you feel like the time was right to go further with Boldly Go?
Well, if I remember correctly, I started writing books about, first of all, it was my experience with Star Trek. That's what they were after. Well, what is your experience in Star Trek so many years ago? And even though it was many years ago that I wrote the first book, I've forgotten the title.
Star Trek Memories.
Star Trek Memories. Huh. And but I couldn't remember anything. It was years later, and I don't know whether it's a product of my mind, my aging mind, or just everybody. I couldn't remember exactly what had happened. You know, it's like, there was a guy named Fetterman, and then Leonard Nimoy was there, but I couldn't remember the story. So I thought, I got to write this book. And I don't know. So I went around to people who were in the show and said, what do you remember? And that happened. So I got my memories from other people. So now I'm out of memories. I don't remember anymore, or I can't get anybody to remember something that they don't remember. Then I realized if I was going to write any more books, it had to be about me. And then I thought, you know, I've got three children, and they're on the verge then, I guess, or maybe it was, I anticipated them having children. I'd leave something behind from these grandchildren who wouldn't know me or wouldn't know. So when I was asked to write a book, I would write something about me because it was the only subject I knew. I mean, I'm a college graduate. I've been acting for a long time, but I don't think you can teach acting. I don't remember anything of the subjects that I learned in college. I think I'm well read, but I'm illiterate. I mean, everything about what I could contribute to the literate world is negligible. The only thing I could contribute that was unique was my experiences. And my experiences were my feelings about X, Y, and Z. And then I had this physical experience or emotional experience, and I would try and discern what it was I felt so I could write that into a book. So the only material I have is myself. Now, I read continuously. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're not talking to me, I'm reading a book. Like there's been a tragedy in my life. My whole library, I bought a new phone, and my whole library that I had in my phone, in my original phone, is gone.
Oh.
I don't know where it went to, but it must be when they got rid of all the information in my first phone, all that information's gone in my new phone. So I don't have a library. So I bought a book immediately, which was something about the woods, about trees, because that's an ongoing subject that I keep reading about. But I don't know enough about, this guy's written The Heartbeat of Trees, I think it's called. I could look it up. So it's all about trees, and I love this connection. What I look forward to is seeing this incredible connection that humans have with the world around them, because we're part of the world around them. But the uniqueness, the information of how we're connected is esoteric, and not many people know about these incredible. So I've read three or four books about trees, and I could tell you that trees send electrochemical signals from the mother tree to the baby trees.
Right, that's right.
It takes care of the babies. We knew for a long while that it sent pheromones downwind. Bugs are attacking, other trees would make their sap more acidic. But now we found out, using the mycelia of fungi, it sends electrochemical signals to the trees. There's a brainwave. We, our dendrites, our brains are sending electrochemical signals along our dendrites. How similar is that brainwave from tree to tree to in our brain? So that connection is always there. So I know a lot, but not a great deal about trees and their electrochemical signals. My whole library is gone. The first book I bought was a new book by Wallabin, this guy who writes about trees and their life. That's the first book I bought to replace all the books that are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying to you, Scott, is the books I write are about myself because I don't know anything else. So I know what it feels like to feel fear. I know what it is like to lose somebody. I know. So I tell those stories because it's the only stories I know. I don't know enough about trees to write about trees, although I've read innumerable things about trees. I have dogs and horses. I understand dogs and horses, but I don't know enough to write a book about them because I read those books about dogs and horses. And I'm like, that's really informative, but I don't know enough. So everything I write is what I feel. And what I feel, I don't think it needs to be held as a closely held secret, because if I feel love, how do I feel love? I'm on the edges of being a poet, and I look to poets. I think, oh God, I wonder if I could do that. So it's being a poet is finding a fresh way of seeing the world that everybody sees, of seeing it and expressing it. So am I a poet if I express what you feel about dirt or fear, you know? So that's why I write. That's why one book seems to be a continuation of the other.
Yeah, it sure does. Okay? It sure does.
It's a long way around, but it's also material for the interview. You follow?
Yeah. But in this book and in the last one, Live Long And ... you said something in the last book that really resonated with me, because I thought that is really, really great advice. That's a great, great words to live by. And I have to tell you how much it actually did enrich my life and reap so many rewards.
Well, what are you going to say?
Say yes to everything.
There you go.
Oh my gosh. I can't tell you how many doors saying yes has opened for me, because even though this door might not be great, the door that opens was awesome.
That's it. So obviously, and I've been criticized for saying that, obviously I don't mean stand on a bridge and say yes to jumping off. I don't mean that.
Yeah.
But if an opportunity that doesn't, upon your intuition and observation, doesn't lead to your dismemberment, you know, why not say at least yes for an exploratory talk? You know, somebody says, let's go out to dinner, then I gotta watch Yellowstone. No, watch Yellowstone later. Go to dinner and get some refreshment from somebody else. Ask people questions. What are they doing? What are they like? And in that refreshment, you refurbish yourself, renew yourself.
You know, in these books that you've written in these last like 10 years or so, You've really, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the philosophy that doing Star Trek all those years ago, the compassion, the family, the knowledge, and you are a very curious person because you ask more questions at these conventions than you get asked by the fans. But did you ever think about how like all that positivity and curiosity of Star Trek has actually rubbed off on you?
Well, I don't know whether it's whether, you know, since you're doing Star Trek, you could say it was Star Trek. But for me, Star Trek was a show. It went on for 3 years. I had 10 pages a day to learn. The people around me were professional. You know, there wasn't this great idea, oh, we're doing a philosophical idea. It was, you got to learn the words and say the words and move on. I don't think it created that curiosity, although I don't remember as a young man, even as a middle-aged man, that I was that curious. I must have been, but I don't remember asking all the questions. But gradually I began to see that the most interesting part of life is people's stories. That's why you've been doing interviews for so long. I mean, everything is of fantastic interest. And I choose the word fantastic because, in a way, it's a fantasy. Whether it's a story about trees, poor Kathleen. Kathleen, I'm on. Bye bye. She is the dearest, Kathleen Hayes.
She's lovely, lovely.
My God, I just love her to death. So she's so looking after me that even though we're past the time when we would have connected, we're she's still after me. Are you okay? Okay. You know what I haven't done? You know where it says in your phone who you an emergency, who what number should you? So what number do you have?
Me?
Yeah.
My fiance's.
It's your fiance.
Yes. Jennifer.
Why haven't you married her?
We're working on it. See? You're asking me the questions.
The title of one of my books. I'm working on that. Well, the reason I ask, obviously, is a fiance has anticipation of something you're going to do, like a marriage ceremony,
Sure.
but you haven't done it. And for reasons that I don't want to get into in an interview on me. So, but it's a temporary, I mean, you don't know how temporary that number is. I'm dying, call my fiance. Your fiance answers, no, I'm sorry, I'm going out with another guy and I can't answer that call. You don't have anybody to call to. So I've got my wife down, but and the doctor. And I'm trying to add another number in my phone, and I won't let me, but I would add Kathleen Hayes's number for an emergency because that's how much I love her, but she loves me. And we've been together 12, 13 years now. And she's like,
I would add Kathleen's number to my phone. That's how awesome she
she
is.
gets everything done. You
Yes,
know, it's
she's wonderful.
unbelievable. Yeah. So that's my way of saying, who would you, what a definitive question that is. You got an iPhone? You're interviewing somebody, yeah? Who have you got down as the person to call in an emergency?
Yep.
I mean, that's your life. That person doesn't answer, or the person doesn't, you know, you could die. I mean, I need, if I'm unconscious in your presence, I need air. Okay, I've got apnea. I could die without being intubated. All right, remember, and your reading audience, intubate me. Great.
One of the things about these last couple of books, especially with Boldly Go, is you are extremely candid with regards to your successes, which there are many, with all of the detours your career has taken, whether it's music and with directing, but also, the tougher times. You're very candid about the tougher times, like right after Star Trek was canceled. So, your job had ended, your marriage had ended, and you went through a really, really hard time. When you write about stuff like that, do you find it's like healing, like it's cathartic for you to like put it
Well,
on
I know
paper?
that's the cliche. Yeah, I wrote about it. Now I don't even know what closure means. What does closure mean? Somebody dies and you bury them. Oh, I got closure? Bullshit. You're thinking about them all the time. You think, God, I just read an article. I read an article just before you and I started talking about a lady whose son about 15 says to her, I'm gay. And she says, oh, God doesn't want you to be gay. And you, and she tries to stop him from being gay, and but he's gay. And after a while, she says, you know, a year, 5 years ago, she says, okay, I accept you, you're gay. And God, but God doesn't like, and he turns to drugs. And then finally, she says, I accept you in any manner you want, years later. So he gets off of drugs, but then for some reason, he gets back on drugs and dies. And now she's saying, if only I had known, if only I could have accepted whatever my boy is, I love him, and I would have loved him for whatever, and I would have loved his partners. I would love, and I'm thinking, that's like terrible. What a regret that is. What a story that is to live with that regret. So there's no closure there.
Right.
That's you go, right. You know, yeah, I got him buried. I got him, and I did a whole article on. Now I got, you don't get closure. Something happens that is terrible in your life. It's part of you. It's part of your sadness, and it's a part of your understanding, and it's a part of your worldliness, because everybody has something happen to them. So closure, there's no such thing. So writing a book doesn't give you closure. It merely describes for my children,
yeah, sure,
what the event was. And in effect, what I'm doing is writing for my kids who don't read my books.
Well, they will.
Yeah, daddy's dead, read a book.
You know, you brought up a name at the top of this conversation, a name I was going to ask you about during this conversation. So
Gary Finnerman.
Exactly. Yes. So first of all, we have sung the praises of Jerry Finnerman many, many times on this show.
On your show?
Yes, because he was a genius.
Genius. He acquired that genius from his father. His father was a well-known cinematographer.
So what was it like working with him?
Well, there was one incident.
And yes.
It tells you everything about him. But here's a guy, usually behind the camera, and if not literally behind the camera, yeah, standing behind the camera, taking measurements and all that kind of thing, in the shadows. He's literally the cinematographer, whether he's a cameraman as well, or is just being the boss of lights and camera, is in the shadows. You never really see him. You could go the whole day with this shadowy figure saying, all right, but put it at 2.5 and get a measurement 15 feet at 2.5 and frame a little, open the frame a little more, and that's all you hear from him. So what was Jerry Finnerman like? It never occurred to me to ask, except that on one day at lunch hour, my phone rang in my dressing room where I was presumably eating, and it was my mother on the phone saying, Billy, your father died, and we're in Miami, and he had a stroke, and he died. I learned later that as he was dying, he was crying. And the mystery, he had tears in his eyes, whether it was tears, I'm leaving. I mean, how do you feel when you die? How do you feel when you die? You've got gray hair.
Yeah.
You're thinking about it from time to time.
I've thought about it, sure.
That's the past tense. Can you put that in the present tense?
I think about it sometimes, sure.
Time to time?
Time to time.
Most times?
Not most times.
a lot of times?
Occasionally.
Occasionally days, months, weeks?
Maybe weeks.
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 I think about it all the time. I think about it when my breath is short. I think about getting up and, oh, wow, look at this beautiful day. I'm so glad I'm alive. I think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Death is right over there. I look at everything, or try to, like I'm never going to see it again. Like I'm looking at you and talking to you, treasuring the words we're saying, because I may never speak again. I may keel over right now.
I hope not. But you were saying about Jerry.
So Jerry, I didn't know until my father died. And then I had to go to Miami to pick his body up at stop production. And I thought, but the plane didn't leave until evening. And it was noon. And what am I going to do between noon and evening? I thought, I got to work. So I tried to work. I couldn't remember a word. It was apparently hellacious. But Leonard, my dear friend Leonard Nimoy, and Jerry Finnerman, whom I knew and didn't know, also stood beside me. I was reminded of film I've seen of elephants supporting older members. They would stand beside them and support them in their hugeness. They would put their shoulder there and support the elderly dying elephant until the elephant would crumble and couldn't move on any further. I had that feeling of two bodies beside me the whole time, Leonard and Jerry. And learned later that Jerry's dad, with whom he was working, like he was on the camera and his dad was behind him as the cinematographer, the very shadowy figure I'm talking about, he worked with his dad until his dad died on the set and he was beside his dad.
Wow. I didn't know that. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had such commiseration. He knew what I was going through. And I had this sense of instant identification with the shadowy figure, Jerry Finnerman, a little overweight, Leonard Nimoy, a little underweight, both beside me, trying to comfort me on the death, on that monumental death in everybody's life, the death of one or two of their parents.
Mm-hmm. You know, since you've written this book, before you wrote this book, you did something that was really, really awesome. You went into space.
I did.
And how was your actual experience different from the experience that people kind of expected you to have?
Well, you see, what you've just enunciated is the problem. Because I wore this costume and sat in this chair and pretended to leave stage 26 for a distant star.
Yeah, yeah.
That, hey folks, it never really happened. So I have no idea what it would be like to go into space. And so through a very obtuse path, I got onto the ship, onto that spaceship, and made it into space. I had seen film of the first voyage, whereby the people there were playing around in weightlessness, and indeed somebody was sprawled out with their legs on their stomach and their legs floating, and somebody was throwing candies at their ass. You know, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, right. So
when I went into weightlessness, I immediately went toward the window and looked out the window. I wanted to experience that 3 minutes to its fullest.
Wow. Wow. And how do you feel like that experience of those 3 minutes has changed you since you've been, you know, back on terra firma?
When I got back and stepped out of the spaceship, I started weeping, started crying. And I thought, what's the matter with me? Why am I crying? And then I realized I was feeling great sadness.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why. And I had to go off in a corner and think about, why am I crying? Imagine crying and not knowing why you're crying. I've never had that experience. I mean, you always know, oh, God, somebody died. Somebody's hurt. I lost a job. You know, Scott Matz wants to talk to me. Oh, I'm going to cry. So it took me a while to understand that I was grieving for the world, for the earth. The very thing that I most caught my attention in the last couple of years is this extraordinary connection that human beings have in the world. I mean, it's a cliche to say, oh yeah, we're all part of the same building materials, but to hear the stories of the incredible unity, one thing depending on the other, that if you take one thing out of the jigsaw puzzle, the puzzle doesn't look complete. And we humans don't understand so much of this jigsaw puzzle, which is the assemblage of nature. The elk in Yellowstone are disappearing, and they don't know why. And they reintroduced the wolves about 20 years ago. And the elks were destroying the waterways because they weren't afraid of anything now, and they could just splash and drink and stay in the streams and destroy the banks. And the banks, without their branches, destroyed the insects, didn't come around because there was nothing for the insects to eat. So then the birds didn't come, there were no insects, and the birds didn't come, and there was no droppings from the birds. So that whole unity of nature, the Yellowstone began to decline. So the scientists said, well, let's reintroduce the wolves. So they reintroduced the wolves. The wolves scared the clovenfoot animal, the deer and the elk and the buffaloes, and scared them, as was always the case for eons, back up into the hills. So they would come and drink and go because they didn't want to tangle with the wolves. So now the streams came back and the bush came back and the insect came back and the birds came back and nature was in harmony. Then the elk started to disappear, and they said, oh, I bet you the wolves are eating the young elk. Well, they hadn't been. No, it couldn't have been the wolves. They began to look around. Then they discovered the fishermen. There were less fishermen in the streams of Montana because there were less fish, less rainbow trout. Why were there less rainbow trout? Then they discovered that they had introduced lake trout into the other lakes. The lake trout were eating the rainbow trout, which was a mainstay of the bears. So the bears, not having the protein of the fish, ate the elk, and the elk were disappearing. So the whole harmony of nature was disturbed by mankind introducing a foreign fish. And that's what's happening in the world around us. Mm-hmm. That's why we're on the precipice of the tragedy of the disappearance of man. Once we disappear, within years, Chesapeake Bay was so polluted we couldn't eat the fish and the shellfish. It was like shellfish. Whole islands in Chesapeake Bay have been made by the bones, the shells of the shellfish by the Indians. They piled the bones, they made islands. There were so many shellfish. No shellfish.
Wow.
Pollution. Mm-hmm. They had an edict, no more pollution here, get by. And within 20 years, Chesapeake Bay is now supplying shellfish to the world. 20 years.
Wow.
Imagine being without us, the world without us for 1,000 years, everything would come back. It's us.
Yeah.
And that's what was made me cry.
Wow.
The loss. Things are going extinct that we don't even know about. There are millions of entities that have taken 5 billion years to evolve, and they're going extinct. As you and I are talking, things are dying out. Things, lots. And we don't know what they are. We don't know the beauty of what the world evolved. Insects, worms, birds. I drove from Los Angeles to someplace near San Francisco and did a Comic-Con, turned around, came back along Highway 5, along the richest valley maybe in the world, or was, San Joaquin. And in the years ago when I did that, 20, 30, 40 years ago when I would do that drive, you'd have to stop every 100, 200 miles, scrape the insects off your windshield.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? One insect in 400 miles, 300 miles there, 300 miles away, 600 miles, one insect splat. In the most fertile, one of the most fertile places on Earth. Where are the insects?
Right. We're doing the damage. And you know what, Bill? I think all it takes is this. We can admit that we're killers, but we are not going to kill today. That's all it takes. And yes, I am quoting.
What'd you have for breakfast?
I had Raisin Bran.
What are you going to have for dinner?
Well, I have to go and cover an event tonight in Hollywood. It's the Hollywood Music and Media Awards. So as soon as I'm done with you, I have to get dressed, and I'm probably just going to have to go get takeout.
Well, you're going to take a chicken. You're going to take a...
Oh, I'll probably get like a chicken sandwich or something.
Yeah, so the chickens are destroying the world too. That's interesting. I'm going to be put in the Music Hall of Fame sometime in the summer at the California Music Hall of Fame. It's the California Music Hall of Fame.
Excellent. Congrats.
It's California.
Yep.
And the Music Hall of Fame. Can you imagine?
That's awesome. And after all those years ago when you first put out Transform Man, now you're getting inducted into the California Music Hall of Fame. Yeah. That's a great
arc, isn't it?
Oh, excellent arc
of Boldly Go.
Yes, absolutely. One more question for you, Bill, is that at 91, you have this drive that I think people a half your age, a third your age should be envious of. And I know you're always looking to your next adventure. So after the California Music Hall of Fame, what is your next adventure?
I've got so many things going on. I've got a hit show called The Unexplained on the History Channel, which is now streaming on, you know, Netflix and everywhere else. And it was number two, they said. When it first was introduced, went number two and then number three, probably not a lot higher than that at the moment, but it's a hit show. They've ordered 35, in the neighborhood of 70 hours for next year.
That's a lot.
You get orders for 10 hours. This is unbelievable. So it's a big hit, and I'm doing all kinds of international publicity. I did a performance at the Kennedy Center with songs that I and Robert Chernow and I wrote, one of which is called So Fragile, So Blue. It was somewhat about the experience I just described on the spaceship. Rob is a poet that, I mean, indescribably good. And the song is monumental. Somebody's putting it up for a Pulitzer Prize. And we're going to do a music video of it. And my dream, my fantasy is that it becomes a rallying cry, like We Are the World. This will be a music video. Everybody's contributing their services to this marvelous song done with a 70-piece orchestra, orchestra there. So that's coming out. We filmed my performance, so that performance is coming out. We did it as an album, so that album is coming out. I've got an album out there now called Bill. This will be called, I don't know, Live.
Bill is awesome. I love it. Yeah, Bill is awesome.
So it goes on and on, the things I'm doing. When I leave you, I'm going to go talk to a producer about a police series that I've got. It goes on. I've got so many things going on. I'm running here and there and trying to read and talk to people like you.
Well, Bill, I cannot thank you enough for talking to people like me today. And
we never got to all your questions, but I hope you allowed me to ramble on.
I so enjoyed this. And yes, we actually did get to most of them. Listen, we've been going episode by episode of the original show and like breaking it down, and not just scene by scene, but like breaking down the production of it and putting into historical context. And one last thing I got to ask is like me and my co-host and producing partner, Steve Morris, we really break it down. Why the hell do you think this series that you did for 3 years holds up under such scrutiny? Why?
Well, my laughable answer long ago was, hey.
Yeah, it's you.
But obviously that's not the case. In script writing, there are certain rules. You got to have an interesting plot, you know, interesting environment, but you have to have people that you love. So here we are in this world of the future.
Mm.
Oh, you mean there's going to be a future? So out of the detritus of what you and I are talking about the world that will disappear in a generation, it doesn't. It exists. Technology takes us out of it. And we're going to exist. Human beings are going to live. And we're going to be 400 years in the future. Everything's going to be good. And we're going to be exploring, not the north, not the eastern coast of the North American continent, but space, where nobody knows what's, and the strange. We know that there are billions and billions constellations. In those constellations, there are billions and billions of stars. Around those stars, there's billions and billions of planets. There has to be, given the urgency of life on this planet, where every niche is filled with life. I mean, I was reading about the small trees, what do you call it, when you nip small trees, make little, the little Japanese help.
I know what you're talking about. I forget the name of the tree.
Where you have little potted trees.
Yeah. I know the tree.
Japan,
yeah.
And here, that's an esoteric skill. It's a skill like sculpting. Come on, help me. So I was reading about that, and I was reading about the most valuable of those trees that are then cut down. They're the trees that grow in niches on cliffside, hammered by the winds and by the sun and by the ocean. They survive. They're thousands of years old. They're small, clinging to a cliff. The imperative of life is such that there has to be life everywhere that is possible. We know that life exists 650 degrees in the water, and where there are vents in the volcanic chimneys, there are worms and clams and things growing, and there's life going on everywhere. Bacteria lived in space. The things come out of space and land in the ocean, land on land, and we see there was bacteria there, alive.
And it's all connected.
It's all connected. So life is all around us. Wait a minute, we think we're the only things in the universe? How bloody egotistical is that?
Yeah, ignorant. You know?
So there's hope invested in Star Trek that we'll be looking at those miracles of whatever you apply that, whatever you think the miracle came about.
Well, the other thing, Bill, is that we do love these characters.
And you love these characters.
We love these characters. And we are so grateful. I'm so grateful for this interview. It is great seeing you as always. Thank you for joining us on Enterprise Incidents. Keep going boldly, William Shatner.
Yes. Take care, my friend. I'll see you.
Thank you. Again.